Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
Hi.
My name is Mark Brusitis, and I...
Hello.
I'm the director of the Creative Writing Program here at WVU. Be odd if I were the director of creative writing at some other university. On behalf of the English department and our chair, Jim Harms, associate chair, Tim Sweet, our calm in the storm, and our director of the Center for Writing Excellence, Laura Brady. On behalf of my colleagues in creative writing, Jim Harms, Kevin Oderman, Ethel Morgan Smith, Alyssa High, Marianne Salmon, Glenn Taylor, thank you all for braving the rain and being here tonight. First, I want to say congratulations to the 12 students who form the Stern Workshop, which begins tomorrow, 7 o'clock. Everyone's ready? You've read all the stories? Ready to go? Yeah. And I want to introduce them, and why don't you all stand, and then at the end we can give them a rousing cheer. Holt Barnett, Mary Casey, Nathan Holmes, Jesse Calvitis, Jesse Lewis, Sarah Lucas, Morgan O'Grady, Connie Pan, Sadie Shore Parks, Joanna St. Germain, Shane Stricker, and Rebecca Thomas. Thank you very much, and congratulations on being in this terrific workshop. So they'll be studying with our reader tonight for three nights running, which is great. I'd also like to announce the winner of the 2012 Virginia Butt Stern Creative Writing Award. It goes to an undergraduate who's concentrating in creative writing and is also majoring in English. And the winner is Caleb Stacey. Caleb, you're here. Stand up. A terrific writer, terrific poet. For the last 2 years, students in my graduate fiction workshop and I have read novels by Jamie Gordon. Last year it was Lord of Misrule, this year it was Bogey One. Far from breeding contempt, familiarity with the author's work has inspired, and this is no exaggeration, fascination, admiration, and devotion. Indeed, when I told my students I would be picking up Jamie at her hotel this afternoon, they asked me if I was nervous. Nervous, I asked. You know, to meet her. We've had a lot of great authors roll through town. Heck, we have a lot of great authors on the faculty. No one had ever asked me if I was nervous to meet them. But I understand. Jamie Gordon has impressed us with her artistry, her inventiveness, her insights into the ragged and yearning and terrible and magnificent human heart. You'll note Jamie Gordon's accolades in the program. There is, most prominently, her National Book Award for Lord of Misrule, a book set at a fictional West Virginia horse racing track. Lord of Misrule's characters are so fully realized, it wouldn't surprise me to see them file in tonight, smelling of the stables and pocketing as many flying WV cookies as they could. I may not have been nervous to meet Jamie, but I would be nervous to meet Tommy Hansen, the novel's unstable hero or anti-hero. So you can read about Jamie Gordon's awards and publications in her program. But all you'll need to know about her great talent can be found in her words. We're lucky, very lucky, to be able to hear them tonight. Please welcome Jamie Poole.
Let's see, does that work okay? Good. I pickled myself in decongestants because I started to get a cold 2 days ago. I was so afraid I'd have laryngitis. I'm really flattered. I mean, I'm very honored to be asked to WVU. First of all, I'm a Mountaineer fan from way back. This is my state in a way. I mean, my novel on which my late big reputation is based is a West Virginia book. I was perfectly accustomed to the idea that it would be a minor kind of novelist up till that point. But even then, I mean, basically I've written a about West Virginia one way or another for a long time, because I have spent as much mental time in West Virginia as anywhere else. I'm from Baltimore, but when I first got out of college, I lived in the Eastern Panhandle, and I have a sister who lives near Clarksburg, not too far from here. And there's her neighbor, Anna Long. Thanks for coming, in spite of the weather. So, and she just got a degree from WVU. Anyway, I feel very glad to be invited here and really interested in what kind of work I'm going to look at from your students. It's extremely varied, which is a great credit to the people who are teaching you. They're just interested in quality. They don't stand for any particular aesthetic. And that really excites me. I think that's the best program, so I like that. And it's especially impressive when it's a small program, a small and intimate program. So it's going to be a very good experience for me, I know, and I hope you all feel that way too. And thank you for Mark for those really, where did he go? There he is. for those words. I mean, the idea that people have been reading me for 2 years is fantastic. Wonderful. Love to hear what you thought about Boogie Woman. How many people here already know the book? Are there, we ended up having a more intimate group than might have been the case if it had been for the weather. So I don't want to tell people something they already know. How many people, maybe I should say, how many people don't know, have not read Lord of Misrule? Don't worry, I won't be, okay, that's plenty. All right, that's what I needed to know. Okay, this is a novel that's written from four principal points of view. There are four principal characters who have a point of view in the book, and a couple of other really important characters besides. The one that might be closest to me personally is Maggie, the lost college girl. She's very green on the track. She only got there because she fell in love with this handsome, scary, unstable young horse trainer. He's gifted, but you know he's no good after you know just a little bit. Tommy Hansel. Tommy is scary enough so that a sensible old groom like Medicine Ed would never be working for him if his own fortunes hadn't taken a kind of a dive. Medicine Ed is 72, he's from South Carolina, and he's been working around horses all his life. He's been on the track since he was 8, so he really never had a chance to go to school. But he knows everything about horses and everything about everybody on the track. The fourth point of view is a loan shark named Tutai, who happens to be related to Maggie. She doesn't really know it, and he doesn't play a very important role in the part that I'm going to read. It's just good for you to know that Tutai is into everybody's pockets and on the track. And when anybody needs money, they'll be talking to him. The characters who don't have points of view but are important, one is Ducie Gifford. Ducie is an old woman, itinerant trainer, what's called a gyp on the track. They usually just have one horse, maybe two. She always has just one until the events happen that happen in the book. The sixth character is the leading trainer at this track. He's kind of the villain of the book. Joe Dale Big is his name. And now after having told you all about these six people, I'm going to say that the character that I'm going to follow some way through the book is a horse, not a person. There are four major human characters, there are four major horses. And the horse that I'm going to read about is Little Spinoza. Little Spinoza is one of the classiest horses at Indian Mound Downs, the junkiest track you can imagine. He sold for $20,000 at Kingland when he was a yearling to Joe Dalbig, that leading trainer, who expected to get a Derby horse out of this terrific colt. But he's never measured up to his class. He has serious behavior problems. In fact, he has the reputation of being a dangerous horse who once kicked Joe Dalbig's son in the head. That's a famous story at the track. Everybody says, the thing with the dentist. So little Spinoza is a problem in the stall and a quitter in the gate who has so enraged Joe Dalbig that he can't even get rid of the horse. He just has to get something of his own back from him. But his son, the one who got kicked in the head, has just gotten out of reform school, and he feels he's got to get the horse out of the way for a while. In order to keep something like peace. So he sells him on the cuff. That's a racetrack expression, meaning nothing in front, pay later when the horse makes some money. To Ducey Gifford, that old lady Jip, figuring he can get him back anytime he wants him, because she's never gonna be able to do anything with the horse, but she fools him. By going in with two other completely unlikely people to buy the horse outright. When a horse is on the cuff, you can, if you can come up with the money, you can buy it. The price is $3,000, and they each put in $1,000. Ducey, Maggie, the lost college girl, Medicine Ed, that African-American groom from South Carolina, and they couldn't be a more unlikely trio to be owning a horse. Now that they have him, they try, first of all, to calm him down. When Medicine Ed finally had little Spinoza alone, he tells it into him, get ready, son. The women are going to take your manhood, he broke the news. Not like it was the end of the world, and next come disease, hospital cases, and death, but like it was a thing the horse ought to know. The first cold had come, and they were walking round and round the shed row in a silver fog that beaded up the cobwebs and the horse's eyelashes. What no idea of mine, I say, wait a short while, see how we do. Nothing ain't gonna change that horse much at his age, I say. He a little bit of a crybaby, that's all, but easy to settle once you riled. You'd be surprised, I tell him. Ain't even all that interested in the senoritas, compared to what you would think. They don't want to listen. They don't want to take no chances. They don't want to lose the edge. I say, what if castration changed in the other direction, into a chuckle-headed girl? They start to laughing. Pretty soon they're cackling like witches. Got me outnumbered, what it is. Medicine Ed checked himself. This was a stab back and two-faced thing to say about the women. They don't mean no harm, he added. He didn't want to be a wrong influence on the horse. What good it do if the horse loved him and hate them others? They have business now. Little Spinoza don't fuss. Matter of fact, he had to admit the horse taken to prancing and corvetting around lately, high in his nature compared to how he used to do. He was always in a good mood these days. Could be too good. Maybe it was the change in the weather. Maybe he don't rightly follow about his manhood. He always was a baby. He's scoping round at the cats, the raindrops pimpling the puddles, the sparrows hopping up and down and cussing each other in the eaves. He stopped and had him a long sniff of Grizzly's goat. Now that Ducey had the two horses, she bought Grizzly a $10 goat to keep him company. When the goat wasn't in the stall, he was tied up like now on a chain in the patch between the shed rows, but he always pulled it out tight as a fiddle string if folks was around, for he was nosy. Medicine Ed returned to the subject at hand. It's one thing you can count on, son. When they gone, they gone. You never know what you're missing. Only thing, you be lighter of heart. Anyhow, he said to the horse. First he spied round to see what devil-born varmint might be listening, a crow, say, or Ducey's slit-eyed goat. You know how I be, a little of a doctor man. I take them things and do you good with them, you hear? You don't have to worry. You're in good hands. But little Spinoza was only interested in that satchel-bellied $10 billy goat. First he jumped back like insulted when the whole goat lifted his head at him and stared. What you think this is, son? Ain't nothing but a spotted he-goat, good for nothing save to be the horse's friend. He gonna urinate in your hay and shove his head in your feed bucket and race you to your eats. You don't mind out, he win, too. You want that? Medicine Ed reached down and touched that peculiar armor-plate forehead of the goat between his coin-slot eyes and shuddered. But little Spinoza danced around and looked happy and want a billy goat all his own. A little time passes, and the vet shows up to do this job. This chapter is kind of famous or infamous for jumping around the point of view at will. Something that's kind of interesting, I mean, that I see is happening a lot in the fiction now. It didn't used to happen so much, but happening these days. When Hazlitt, the vet, finally showed up with his little bag in the afternoon in the rain, looking mud-spattered and harassed, Ducey happened to have taken a ride into town to buy a pair of reading glasses at the dime store. Tommy, who had been asked to help if this happened, Maggie winced. Somehow she hadn't gotten around to telling Tommy yet who's all horse little Spinoza actually was. Paraded them all out to the grass patch at the end of the shed row, where it was cleaner and they would have more room. And then they stood there in the cold drizzle, shifting from foot to foot while Tommy dragged away the $10 goat that Ducey had bought for Grizzly. They had forgotten about the goat. Maggie held the interested but unsuspecting little Spinoza, who, despite his notorious encounter with a racetrack dentist, everyone knew that story, seemed more drawn by the weird blue crucifix eyes of the goat than troubled by the brusque stranger with the black bag. Little Spinoza was still looking over his shoulder into the empty stall, his own, where the small but smelly and baaing goat had disappeared. When a little commotion happened at his neck, and suddenly the earth fell up to meet him, his blood turned to warm solder, his penis dropped limp out of his body, and his knees melted. He sank to the grass. His elbows and stifles drained away. He rolled over on his side. His huge tongue wanted to fall out of his mouth. He was not sleepy, but gravity had won a great victory, and he wished never to get up again. He watched incuriously as the two men went around behind him and squatted, and one of them somehow picked up his leg and moved it a little and held the great black riverine tail out of the way. There was a pleasant tinkle of metal, a feeling of deep and strange, but painless emptying. Another not so agreeable, snip, 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 snip. Two grayish pink, wet, egg-like bodies, sparsely threaded with blood vessels, lay in the grass. That was it. Already his face looked less alien and goofy. They stood there waiting for his legs to come back under him. The queerest thing was the long, thin, infinitely elastic tubes hanging down like spittle from the shiny balls before Hazlitt sniffed them away. Maggie saw Medicine Head slide out of the tack room and pick up the testicles out of the grass in a silver can. It could have been a soup can, nicely washed out and with a label neatly removed. And then he faded away again, presumably around the corner. She blinked. She hadn't known he was there. In fact, he hadn't been there, or Tommy would certainly have called him over and made him drag away the $10 goat instead of doing that ridiculous job himself. These days when Maggie was alone with little Spinoza, after he had walked or worked and had his bath, she rubbed him. She didn't exactly know the derivation of this ancient slang for what a groom is supposed to do to a horse. Only that was what the old guys told people they did. and rubbing horses nigh on 35 years now, or back when I rubbed horses for Happy Blunt at Hot Springs, whatever it meant. But she sensed the thread had been dropped somewhere, the root to some secret heart of this business had been lost. She didn't know anyone who literally rubbed a horse, not even old Ducey. She asked a medicine Ed. That come from way back, in England or Paris, France or somewhere, when the thoroughbred racehorse run 5 miles over open ground, hills and stone walls and that, and come back half dead under a blanket to a barn with no running hose water, let alone hot. So they rubbed the horse dry and warm. Babies get rubbed, he added. If you work for a barn that got babies. Rich folks had babies. Tommy Hansel had the geezers of the trade. Back in Charlestown, she had hauled to the laundromat a bunch of old croaker's tacks she had found in the Pichot's barn. They had been many times stained, washed, and dried until they were the color of a healing bruise. Long ago, someone had left the pile of them stiffening in a corner. But they washed out soft and sweet. And now she rubbed little Spinoza with them from his ankles to his ears. She rubbed in a round, hypnotic, finger-painting motion, but hard, feeling for some remotely erotic synapse of his ease from the ends of her fingers into his bones and muscles, which wasn't as easy through the pink gunny as it had always been barehanded with Pelter. She had to slow down time, go into a kind of trance state where sweet electricity pooled at her nerve endings like nectar on the pistil of a honeysuckle. And then by running her fingers over the animal, she could find his hidden landing places. Not that these were jungle airstrips, few and hard to find. They were all over the place. But you had to approach the body boundary reduced to this one brooding spark. You dangled from a headland, black, empty space rushing by, and suddenly you were across. The key was being tuned down so fine that you felt the crossing. Without that, your fingers were just dead prongs on a rake, and nothing happened. So it helped to be stoned, which he was rather often. Zeno had left behind in the crushed trailer a chunk of hashish the size of a square of baking chocolate, the ginger color and yielding consistency of puppy feces. And Tommy had bought it from Medicine Ed, who had no use for that stuff, for a yard. Plenty of times, they had a little curl like a cedar shaving for breakfast. Rubbing little Spinoza without it took more concentration, a willed death of talky ratiocination up there under the pigtails. She had to hang up on the telephone of her mind, and then it worked. Oh, didn't it work? Come to find out, the dangerous speculation grandson was a pushover, the model of innocent delight. It was alarming, in fact, how trusting he was. Once you made him feel good, how forgiving of all the predecessor pain, how unsuspecting the joy would ever end. Unlike Pelter, who shot up out of her intimate handling from time to time without warning, with a rip-roaring snort and the urge to do mischief, to nip, or kick. Little Spinoza melted away into the dream of bliss. He let her do anything to him. After she rubbed him dry and warm, she brushed him deep all over with an ordinary charwoman's scrub brush, then every day worked a little at his mane and tail, patiently dug through and pulled the years of knots and snags. Little Spinoza stood for all of it. His dapples came up like God's gold fingerprints. He crackled. He glowed. Even when she felt the pleasure running along his withers and flanks, in waves and literally crimping up his spine, he didn't protest, just bent into it like a ballerina in a pas de deux. Look at you, big silly. How are you ever going to fend for yourself, she mumbled into the warm curve of his back. But then you never were a man's man either, were you? Well, I hope you can still run now that you're not scared. She looked him in the eye, and he blew into her face a great warm drench of hay flowers. So they take little Spinoza to his first race, and it's a terrible race. I mean, it looks like he's going to be ready. They get the best jockey on the track to ride him, and he completely comes apart. He goes crazy in the gate, worse than ever. He disappears out of sight, and when the gates clang open, the jockey is hanging to his side. So he's really scared for his life. And at the end of the race, he literally throws the horse. I mean, first of all, he's slashed the horse with his whip in a bad way. Then he throws the horse at them without even handing over the reins, so the horse takes off towards the infield. After that, he has a worse reputation than ever, and they can barely find somebody to ride him. They have to tap their exercise girl, who has just become what's called a bug boy on the racetrack, an apprentice rider. She's legal to ride, but that's about the most you can say about Alice at that point. But she's sure she knows something about this horse. So at least when they take him to a second race, the next race after the very, very bad race, nobody knows what to expect. Now we're back in Medicine Ed's point of view. Seemed like every day since time you've been thinking what a shame and pity it is how the world is coming down, how the pride of work has disappeared until they just laugh at him, the boys that come on the racetrack now, how the horses is misused and abused, started out racing too young before they had bones as hard, not rested proper, and dosed with all kind of shots and pills, and so consequently don't last. How these five and dime horse trainers and the 10-cent owners anymore be tighter than the bark on a beech tree when it come to anything but rush them horses back to the track and collect a bet. It ain't no real sportsman around here no more if it ever was, or either sportswomen. And John Q. Public wasn't no dumber than he used to was, but also he ain't no smarter. Seemed like since time, that was the most fun old medicine I'd been having. Studying on it every day, how this good thing has come down and this other thing that once was fine has went to pieces on him until he'd be sick and tired of his own self. And then he'd land up in his masculine trailer in the deep of night, mumbling through his bald gums and mixing up some pocket Toby to get his own back, snatching blind at any thread that may be tying his luck to him. And which is why every now and then when some kind of a good thing come together in nature and make the whole world new, seemed like once again he had found that harmony, how there is a power in charge and strong secret threads lead around and under and tie it all together. And which is what happened that night with little Spinoza. He might have known that Alice Newsom, who didn't resemble no other human being he has ever seen, man nor either woman, would have to be a luck thrower of some kind. The way she looked, not ugly, but like something born between mud and river water, like something out of a creek swamp. Person must figure fate has already laid a shaping hand on her and is satisfied, or can't do no worse, or maybe mean to make it even to her in some way. Nothing in little Spinoza's routine changed behind that bad race. It was still Alice on little Spinoza at 4:15 in the morning, an old Deucey peering into the fog from the river with her spyglass and stopwatch, clocking little Spinoza's little bit of speed. And which was still there, the speed, but now it ain't even no one to hide it from. Early Beaufay has done them the favor to badmouth little Spinoza and his trainer and three cockamamie owners too. Horse be no count, they say. Killer in the gate and a quitter in the stretch with a hard, ruinated mouth. One more incident and management Bombi stamping his folding papers, not fit for racing. And the apprentice jockey them three have found under a rock somewhere since early quit them, townie, a female, and ugly enough to scare a hound dog off a gut wagon. And a bug boy at that. You know how they say about a bug boy, he saved you 7 pounds in the gate and add 30 pounds in the stretch. And this is a horse even early Beaufay couldn't get no stretch run out of him. So this time, for 2 weeks, everybody keep that clear of the horse you think he carry that equine encephalitis. Not even Joe Dale Big come round. And then Ducey drops him in for 3,000. Everybody think they see them coming. Everybody figure the plain, obvious truth. Them are the broke, pitiful owners of Little Spinoza that done shelled out their last $2 bill on that horse. The colored groom, the he-she trainer, and the lost college girl, them three, are gone try and get a claim for what they paid for him, which was far too much money already. But what Alice hears him say is this. Whoever come up with that idea that Little Spinoza has early speed, he has speed all right. And it is an exact amount coiled up in him the way a black snake will live snug under your well cover all winter. He is a one-run horse, but of a very classy kind, Alice said. He has an exact amount of speed which could last an exact time from the last possible moment when you call on him until that wire. But until now, he has squandered it early. He is like some corner zoot suitor cut loose with his mama's death benefit before he has become a man, before he has grown sense to put it in the bank or either a choice bit of real estate. He come out the gate going every which way in terror and pure foolishness. Ego every which way, and finally he tire and die. And if the boy hit him, he wither up besides. And yet, he is a dreamer horse. The like to look at ducks splashing down on the river and hawks sailing on the wind. How say, what if he can sleep like Sleeping Beauty, only on his feet with no pain, and stay asleep till I wake him up at the quarter pole? And Medicine Ed can follow her idea, as long as the pace up front ain't too slow. As long as the front runners be halfway honest, he might could get there. To rate him, Alice has to hypnotize the horse a little, and she says she can do it. How can she? Oh, she has her little ways, she say. Maybe I sing him to sleep. And she smiles that no-lip smile that put Medicine Ed in mind of a newt. Alice couldn't prove it. She showed them in a little trial with Grizzly and Miss Fowlerville and Railroad Joe how little Spinoza comes swooping by in the stretch. True, their mother's wasn't but $2,000 or even $1,500 horses. And two belonged to Hansel, but the young fool had suddenly drove off somewhere for 2 days to see about a horse and left a Medicine Ed in charge. Naturally, a lit-up grandstand and 1,000 screaming betters be something different from dark and silence at first morn, let alone a paddock judge poking in his mouth and the starter man grabbing his ear or snatching his lip in the gate. All the same, that is Alice's idea, which do have the beauty to tie all the parts together. They look for a weekend race, so it is a decent handle. They don't talk about it, but they all fix it to cash that bet. Won't anybody in the house like Spinoza, save for them three, thank you, Lord. Of course, Medicine Ed must tell Tutai, for he will need him a small advance. And Tutai have his own people, no way around that. And might probably that old porcupine Ducey have somebody she got to let in, some orphan or hard case. And who can doubt but what the frizzly haired girl gonna tell the young fool all? The old Ducey may have suspicioned that maybe she liked this week on purpose when Hansel has disappeared somewhere to see a man about a horse. All signs saying that Saturday, first Saturday in December, be a fair day and a good track. Not wet and heavy, nor either too hard froze. And soon as there was a card to study, Ducey and Medicine Ed and Alice went over the entries, prepared to scratch if it was no speed in the race. But there was two clear front runners for sure going to fight it out up there. The one horse ink spot and the six horse, maybe something. And the four horse might be in it too, Medicine Ed disremembered the name. Little Spinoza drew post position number 8 in an 8-horse race, but this time that high number worked to his good. This way, Little Spinoza automatically be the last to load in the gate instead of a problem case, getting the starters nervous and mad until they might do something in anger that could hurt the horse, or worse, wake him up. And anyhow, Alice Newsome been with Little Spinoza in the gate 3 times already since that bad race, and say he is cured. The word put me wise. Alice Newsome say she gonna sing Little Spinoza to sleep, and that is exactly what she do. Then 3 are standing in the gap for the post parade when Alice and Little Spinoza tack by, and all 3 look at each other and their mouths fall open, and they close them again. Ducey yanks the stiffened handkerchief out from under her flask and wipes her head. The frizzly-haired girl laughs kind of funny time behind her hand. Deep in his pocket, Medicine Ed rubs a red flannel bag between dog finger and thumb, for they had heard Alice singing. It ain't a big voice, but pointy and sharp as a stick. By and by, when the morning comes, all the saints, why, it's a song his mother used to sing in church, one he knew long ago. All the saints gone gathering home. And maybe it is his imagination, but he think Little Spinoza is listening. The horse go along last in line, far away in his face, but collected. His ears prick up tall, quivering. And there is Alice, high up on his back, with her little bony knees pointed in, hypnotizing him with her small, steely voice. Alice leaned into his neck in them raggedy silver silks, which Ducey bought for 4 bits from somebody's stable that was busting up. Medicine Ed had to pin them together behind her neck with a bandage pin. He never hear no announcement so many minutes to post time. He hear his mother's voice from the wings of New Life Baptist Church in Cambrai, not a little metal thread wire like Alice's, but big as a house. In the land of perfect day, when the mist has rolled away, we will understand it better by and by. Then he ain't hear nothing. His mother's voice was all around him. He didn't recall looking at no tote board, but yet and still, he knew when the numbers stand at 35 and fall to 22, back up to 25 and 22, and all of a sudden down to 12. And then the horses were at the gate and in the gate, each by each. He saw Little Spinoza step into the 8 slot, civil as you please, like a man walk in a cloakroom to ask for his hat. Then they break, and it was all 8 of them in a line. Yes, Little Spinoza was right with the others on top of his feet drumming in that cold sand, his head stretching forward. Then Medicine Ed get that draggified, sunken feeling that him and Ducey and the frizzly-haired girl be the only ones looking. The only ones looking where Little Spinoza be at, that is. For where he was, there wasn't no other horses to see. Then they was all together in one small sinking boat, him and Ducey and the frizzly girl and Alice and Little Spinoza. That's how far back Little Spinoza was running. They hadn't no strength even to shout his name. Trouble cotton up their lungs. Disappointment sit heavy on their heads. They can just about lift their chin and watch. There was no way in the world that horse could make it back in this race. That Alice Newsome so far off in her reining until she had to be thinking of getting there yesterday, maybe tomorrow, not today. Medicine Ed look up front. It's a whole nother race going on up there. The 4 horse trying to open it up in front. The 1 horse stalking him 2 lengths back on the rail, and the 3 horse dogging the 1 horse on his elbow. And the rest of the field knotted up on the inside 5, 6 lengths back, like soup greens hanging off a long spoon. But even if you want to lose Little Spinoza in this pack, you can't. He is lollergagging along 10 lengths back of the others, dead last. Medicine Ed has gone to be not 250, but 450 in the hole with Two Time. And Two Time himself will take a beating in the race. Medicine Ed will look like a damn fool more than what he already do. And on top of that, his good credit gone. Just when he wanted to drop his head and his hands for shame, Medicine Ed hear the words, "We will understand it better by and by." And that's when little Spinoza start to make his move. Alice climb up some way on his neck and take hold, but she don't use no stick. They have got just 3/8 of a mile to go, and they don't even look at that mess on the inside. In their hurriment, they go round. And there it is again, gobbling up ground like a black steam shovel. Here come little Spinoza and Alice flying up the stretch. Here come the speculation grandson flat out, sailing around the 6 and 7 horse and sliding up between the 5 and the 2 like a black polished cloth in a mahogany hand, opening, closing, opening it out again. Inside the 4 horse, you done faded out of it. And the 3 horse, you make one last push, but it ain't enough. And swooping up on Ink Spot, his boy looked round at the wire, but it is too late. Only Deucey yelled a little. Medicine Ed done lost his voice. He bowed his head for the beauty of it and because it come from his dead mother. Also, the frizzly-head girl ain't squeal nor holler. Her eyes was wide and shining, and she sink her fingers into his bony arm behind the elbow and squeeze so hard it hurt. "I can't believe I saw that," she said. "It was so great." For once, he almost liked her hungry ignorance, which at least it wasn't small or mean. The 3 of them headed for the winner's circle, floating on that cloud through the people towards the gap, just believing their luck, kicking through dead tickets and grease-pearled pizza plates, hardly moving their feet. Man takes his picture. Then they waiting to see what little Spinoza will pay. In that cloud, Medicine Ed ready to feel free. He wished Gazzino was alive to see him, or Charles Philpott. He wished anybody was alive to see him. The young fool was way up north somewhere seeing a battle horse. He hinted it was an owner in the works. The young fool had been let in a winking, sporting way. He had rode $10 on little Spinoza, but he didn't have no faith. Only when Medicine Ed caught Joe Dale Big standing yonder outside the winner's circle, he come down to earth with a thump. For Ed could see it. Joe Dale believed. Joe Dale believed, and it was worse than the other white boss disbelieving that the 3 were able. Joe Dale Big believed more than it was there to believe in. He believed it had all been one big plan, which was to make him look like a fool. Joe Dale Big was a half-bald man with a big forehead. Just now the forehead glow in front of the boiled egg. His thick hair stand out a little crumped from his head. His dark eyes were watching them 3. His arms was folded across his chest like a judge. Medicine Ed remembered to take the little red flannel bag between his fingers and softly rub. He knew he couldn't do nothing for Deucey. Her trouble was coming. He knew the frizzly-haired girl must suffer too, but he would be safe. Inside his pocket piece used to be anvil dust and a thumbnail of blue getaway goofer powder dressed with a drop of Jockey Club Fast Luck oil he ordered from Lucky Heart Curios, Memphis, Tennessee. Every dime store conjurer in South Carolina had the same. But now it's a strong leave-alone powder in there too. He has the scooped up going-away tracks of all 3 of them white bosses at the mound, who like to scheme and get in your business and can't be satisfied and want it back, what any many little bit of anything you finally lay hold of. This speckled stuff give him keep-away power over the stall man, Suitcase Smithers, and racing secretary Chenille, and the leading trainer, Joe Dale Big. And just in case, his boss, Tommy, is in there too. Medicine Ed taking the red flannel bag between his fingers and rub. He said, In the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost, I ask you to take all the bad luck off me and make it go on them. You're trying to take from me what I got and rightly win. Put the harm on them and let it go back to the devil where it come from. And he rubbed and listened to them clicking softly together in the strong leave-alone powder. The carefully parched, manly parts of little Spinoza smoked down to the size of marbles over a dry wood fire.